Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear the 37th Annual Henri J. Renard S.J. Endowed Lecture in Philosophy, presented yearly by the Creighton University Department of Philosophy. This year's guest speaker will be Daniel Dahlstrom, John R. Silber Professor of Philosophy at Boston University, and author of several books, including The Heidegger Dictionary and Philosophical Legacies, Essays on the Thought of Kant, Hegel, and Their Contemporaries. He'll speak on the topic Authenticity and Humility. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, March 23, 2017, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Amy Wendling, Chairman of the Department of Philosophy at Creighton University.
The lecture series is named to honor Reverend Henri J. Renard S.J., a respected and beloved professor of philosophy at Creighton University during the years 1947 to 1969. Many Creighton University students used philosophy books authored by Father Renard as they pursued the traditional sequence of philosophy courses within the philosophical system of St. Thomas Aquinas. Father Renard was a philosopher, an author, a musician, a retreat master, a lover of art, a spiritual director, and a teacher. Past Renard lecturers have included Anscombe, Nussbaum, Robert Pippin, Jonathan Lear, and Eleanor Stump. Tonight's lecture is presented with the generous support of the Endowment for the Henri J. Renard S.J. Endowed Lecture in Philosophy. I will now turn you over to Professor Patrick Murray, who will introduce our wonderful speaker.
Thank you, Dr. Wendling. So, it is my privilege to introduce our speaker tonight, somebody from whom I've been learning philosophy for about 46 years, since starting as a toddler. And that is Professor Daniel Dahlstrom, a philosopher and a scholar, especially of modern German philosophy, but really of many aspects of philosophy, many topics, many philosophers, especially perhaps Martin Heidegger. Professor Dahlstrom is the John R. Silber Professor of Philosophy at Boston University. He taught previously at the Catholic University of America and before that at Santa Clara University. Dr. Dahlstrom earned his PhD degree at St. Louis University, writing a dissertation on Hegel's logic, which I had the privilege to deliver to some of his readers, and that was with Professor James Collins. Daniel Dahlstrom is the author of The Heidegger Dictionary with Bloomsbury, a very fine book and great resource for us. Philosophical Legacies, Essays on the Thought of Kant, Hegel, and Their Contemporaries. Heidegger's Concept of Truth, which was originally written in German and then later translated into English. And he's been involved in a number of important translations, including Heidegger's Introduction to Phenomenological Research, Hegel's Encyclopedia of the Philosophical Sciences, Part 1, The Science of Logic, and Edmund Husserl's Ideas 1, 2014. He's the editor of some 16 books, including Interpreting Heidegger, Critical Essays. Daniel Dahlstrom's been awarded numerous research grants and was a 1997 recipient of an undergraduate Philosophy Club Excellence in Teaching Award. He's been a leader in the philosophical community, so he's served on the Executive Council of the Society for Phenomenology and Existential Philosophy, SPEP, as we know it, the presiding officer of the Heidegger Circle, president of the Metaphysical Society of America, and recently president of the American Catholic Philosophical Association. So, someone who's excelling as a researcher, a teacher, and a leader in professional organizations. So it's a very special occasion for us to welcome Dan Dahlstrom. Dan, welcome. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation. It's truly an honor. I look at those list of speakers, and I feel I'm humbled by it, which I'm going to talk about tonight, but I truly do. So thank you very much. It's also a great joy to see old friends, and as Professor Murray says, we're old friends. We started out together in St. Louis U. There were 29 people in our class, believe it or not. They accepted a lot of people in graduate school back then. It was the Vietnam time. But two of us got out. So here we are. Okay. So the title of the paper is Authenticity and Humility. In the third scene of the opening act of Hamlet, as Ophelia's brother Laertes is about to embark for France, his father Polonius gives him, as fathers are wont to do, some worldly advice. Some lines are as memorable as they are prudent. For example, give every man thy ear, but few thy voice. Or, neither a borrower nor a lender be. But none has become a more permanent fixture in modern sensibilities than Polonius's final words of advice, this above all, to thine own self be true. Yet while there is general consensus on the value of this last bit of advice, its call to authenticity faces an array of philosophical challenges. One challenge stems from the allegedly fragmentary character of our experiences. We can hardly be true to ourselves if there is no self, no identity across those experiences. Other challenges stem from a sense of how much society shapes our personal identities. Be true to your own social construct is presumably not what Shakespeare had in mind. In my remarks today, however, I want to zero in on a different but related challenge to Shakespeare's injunction, the challenge presented by our fondness for others' esteem. The challenge arises from worrying about others' regard for us. The challenge is to come face to face with ourselves despite what others might like us to be. This challenge is in some ways the most formidable challenge to authenticity, arising as it does from a deep-seated tendency to base our self-conceptions solely on a desire to have others view us positively. The challenge is existential and personal. We can decide to yield to this tendency or to resist it, and we know in our heart of hearts that on some level we cannot escape making this decision. The challenge has the power to sabotage the attempt to be authentic, because it bases our self-conception on a presumed relation to others, where the presumption trumps reality, the truth about ourselves. Despite some modern views to the contrary, there's a long history of recognizing this threat. In Judeo-Christian terms, the threat takes the form of a temptation. But it is not just any temptation. It is, as Augustine puts it, quote, the most dangerous temptation, the love of praise, end of quote. A temptation to which we have always already fallen prey, more or less. Augustine provides a striking account of the perversity of this temptation, rooted as it is in a desire to be feared or loved by others, a desire that becomes inordinate when it strives to secure a joy that is in reality sheer fantasy. A person thinks herself more or less estimable than she is in order to seem deserving of the esteem from others that she craves, the sort of esteem that warrants their fear of her or their affection for her. By giving in to that craving and crafting an image of herself to satisfy it, she is true, not to herself, but to what she thinks will win others' praise. Pride, so conceived, presents the supreme threat to being authentic. Now, contemporary thinkers have recognized a version of this challenge to authenticity, albeit under supposedly competing and novel rubrics of sincerity and authenticity. According to Lionel Trilling, sincerity, quote, the avoidance of being false to any man through being true to one's own self, end quote, is a new element in the history of the moral life of Europe, as is the specific coinage of the term, supposedly not in use before Shakespeare. The same, he suggests, applies to authenticity, an idea that in turn allegedly displaces sincerity from its privileged status. These claims are remarkably parochial, I think, brushing aside as they do a bevy of irrelevant ancient and medieval meditations on the virtue of being true to oneself. So when Abelard's Shitote Ipsum, know yourself, or even the know thyself in the ancient Aeschylus, from Trilling's point of view, that reflexive doesn't refer to a robust self. It's modern. Sincerity and authenticity are modern. Now, these complaints that I have with it, I think, are warranted, but they should not keep us from appreciating Trilling's insight into a prominent path taken by literature in modernity. He notes how a new antagonism to the heroic style arose in the Renaissance. The heroic was regarded not only as absurd, unrealistic, but also a hindrance to the practical conduct of life. The trend, epitomized in the work of Cervantes, Fielding, and Swift, supposedly reflected an increasing concern with ordinary life and practices. But it also led to a new definition of the hero, or at least to an emphasis on, quote, an individual's experience of his existence, the sentiment of being, end of quote. According to Trilling, Rousseau's belief in sincerity, exemplified in the project of his Confessions, is central to this development. Rousseau is said to display the sort of intense conviction of his sincerity and the truth of his own experience that allegedly grounds a newly awakened power and authority to criticize the political and social order. Yet Rousseau's project comes to grief, not simply because of its insincerity, as many critics point out, but because Rousseau bases sincerity on a conception of an adulterated, private, unified self. Naturally pure, this inner self is essentially bifurcated from society, corrupted by it, but also capable of redeeming society by elaborating, teaching, and enforcing the duties of, quote, honest individuals, end of quote. According to Trilling and Bernard Williams, and many others who follow in their footsteps here, the figure of Rameau's nephew in Diderot's work by that name spectacularly supplies what Rousseau's conception of sincerity lacks, namely a conception of a self alienated down to its roots and fully aware of the fact. The nephew is a parasitic but intelligent buffoon, alternately ingratiating and offending the segments of society from which he lives. Yet all the while, Rameau's nephew is at times not only to an unusual degree sincere, but seemingly authentic. In the dialogue, he demonstrates that he is no different from honest individuals, thereby exposing their insincerity and with it, quote, the loss of personal integrity and dignity that the impersonations of social existence entail, end quote. Trilling claims that Diderot's portrait of the nephew is also meant to suggest that moral judgment is not ultimate. So you might think about, my son is memorizing all these movies, the top 10 movies on IMDb, and so he watches all these movies. So think of film noir and the anti-hero in film noir and that influence on French existentialism coming from American movies, this anti-hero. So there's a certain reverberation here with that. So the idea that moral judgment is not ultimate. The claim seems rash and even untoward given his view, Trilling's view, that Diderot draws the portrait to pass moral judgment on society. Yet the main point of the comparison between Rousseau and Diderot is to underscore a growing sense that sincerity is not enough, at least if it means, paraphrasing Williams' paraphrase of Hegel, feeling unreflectively at home in one's social environment. In addition to demonstrating that sincerity does not guarantee the purposes of virtue, as Rousseau seems to have thought, Diderot's portrait of Rameau's nephew raises, in Bernard Williams' terms, quote, a more radical question, how far the self can be expected to be receptive to morality at all, end of quote. Trilling draws the contrast between Rousseau and Diderot to illustrate how sincerity, supposedly the moral ideal of early modernity, gives rise to the 18th century, in the 18th century, to a different moral ideal, authenticity. While both he and Williams are short on specifics, the difference between the two ideals seems to turn on the possibility that a person can deliberately convey to others what she takes her beliefs or feelings to be while being mistaken, having false beliefs, or even having feelings irreconcilable with who, at her deepest level, she is. In this sense, according to this view, she can be sincere, but inauthentic. Trilling also casts the distinction in terms of the necessary role of expression in sincerity. Sincerity supposes an expression, and an expression is distinct from the mindset responsible for it, allowing for a question of veracity to arise. By contrast, in cases of authenticity, the distinction cannot be meaningfully sustained. As a means of illustrating this difference, Trilling appeals to Wordsworth's depiction of Michael the shepherd, who, having lost his son to the city, sits silently in the hills with his flock, expressionless. As Trilling puts it, quote, "There is no within and without. He and his grief are one," end of quote. Trilling insists sincerity simply does not suffice to capture this reality. Authenticity does. Summing up his argument, Trilling writes, "A very considerable originative power had once been claimed for sincerity, but nothing to match the marvelous generative force that our modern judgment assigns to authenticity, which implies the downward movement through all the cultural superstructures in some place where all movement ends and begins." As this text makes clear, maybe when you're thinking about it, just ask yourself, how do you use sincerity and authenticity, or how do you think of them in relation to one another? So the argument here was that authenticity somehow supersedes sincerity, and you can be one without the other. As this text makes clear, the fact that sincerity is bound to an expression makes it, on Trilling's account, irretrievably beholden to cultural convention. The very conventions that make it possible for the sincere person to express feelings and beliefs to others. By contrast, authenticity is said to reach, quote, "as far down beneath the constructs of civilization as it was possible to go, the irreducible truth of man, the innermost core of his nature, his heart of darkness," end of quote. That heart of darkness is obviously referring to the book by Conrad, or, as my son says, Apocalypse Now. The accuracy of this version of the literary and political history of modern Western European ideas of sincerity and authenticity is obviously controversial. But the historical narrative makes an important point, namely that these ideas have been seen to come apart, that we can judge someone to be sincere yet inauthentic. We can see, for example, even if she can't, that she's acting this way, saying the right things, candidly conveying her feelings, but only because others expected of her. Authenticity trumps sincerity on this view because the latter, in contrast to the former, is inevitably co-opted for the social trappings by the social trappings of its expression. It would seem on this view that Shakespeare's exhortation to be true to ourselves cannot, without further qualification, be an exhortation to sincerity. Now, I want to challenge that. I want to argue against that. I have several reasons, but one is it overlooks the numerous ways in which I can be true to myself only by being true to others and vice versa. If a friendship is essential to who we authentically are or can be, then so too is sincerity, since there can be no friendship without sincerity. Inauthentic sincerity is all too common, to be sure, but far from ruling out the possibility of authentic sincerity, inauthentic forms of sincerity live like parasites off the experience of authentic sincerity. Living like sincerity between friends, moreover, authentic sincerity is integral to living authentically. Both sincerity and authenticity are desirable, not simply in this or that instance, but throughout a life as a fundamental part of its orientation. In other words, personal identity, and by extension, authenticity, are not fully completed states, but ongoing, more or less habituated processes directed at ideals. Now, I want to argue that sincerity and authenticity, being true to others and being true to ourselves, as you may have guessed from what I've just said, I want to argue that those are virtues. But I also want to insist that they are not particularly modern. They're not novel to modernity. The virtue of being true to ourselves is already a staple of classical accounts of the virtue of magnanimity. In particular, Aquinas' astute pairing of magnanimity with humility outlines the necessary means of contending with the love of others' praise as the primary challenge to being authentic. So that's sort of my contention, what I'm going to try to argue for. And his pairing of magnanimity and humility entails authentic sincerity, the deliberate attempt to be truthful. Now, any review of Aquinas' account of magnanimity must begin, as he does, with Aristotle's portrait of the magnanimous person as someone who, quote, thinks himself worthy of great things and is truly worthy of them, end of quote. Of all the things external to human beings that matter to them, Aristotle deems honor the greatest. It is the greatest external good. A magnanimous person is someone who has the right sort of disposition towards honor. This is really difficult. The right disposition toward honor. That disposition is not so much a concern for honor as such. After all, Aristotle observes, a magnanimous person, quote, counts honor for little, end of quote, which is why that person sometimes seems arrogant or even disdainful for the sorts of honors that others can confer. Being disposed towards honor in the appropriate way consists instead of having an accurate sense of one's deservedness or worthiness of honor, what is generally understood by a person's honorableness and behaving accordingly. A magnanimous person, in other words, considers herself worthy of honor without striving to be honored. She does not care about being honored because she knows that any honors she might receive are incommensurable with her virtuousness, what makes her deserving of honor. In sum, magnanimity is the subtle disposition of managing the pleasure taken in being honored and the ensuing concern or desire for honor. It is the subtle disposition of managing these emotions in the right way, such that a person is cognizant of her honorableness but esteems it neither too much nor too little. Now, like any virtue, magnanimity is produced through a process by which practical reason repeatedly guides an emotion. In this case, presumably the pleasure that accompanies the recognition of being worthy of honor, but guides it in an appropriate, moderating manner. In the case of magnanimity, practical reason provides that guidance by presenting the person with a true estimate of her worth, steering a path between overestimating herself, pride, and underestimating herself, pusillanimity. The Aristotelian virtue of magnanimity is, in short, the virtue concerned with being authentic, with being true to ourselves in the sense of our true worth, regardless of what some others think of us. Now, there's two further aspects of Aristotle's account that are relevant here. First, magnanimity goes hand in hand with excelling in each of the virtues, is a task of a lifetime. There is, in other words, no magnanimity without complete virtue. And all-around virtuousness is what separates a magnanimous person from imitators. Those arrogant individuals who consider themselves worthy of honor and superior to others solely because of their fortune, superior social position, riches, or power. If there is ever a virtue that entails the unity of the virtues, it is magnanimity. Aristotle, in fact, deems it the crowning virtue, the jewel, cosmos, of the virtues, because it both makes them greater and does not come about without them. But for that very reason, because it is not possible without a certain noble goodness, Aristotle adds, he insists on this, that it is truly difficult to be magnanimous. This last remark reminds us, I think, that magnanimity, like any virtue, is fundamentally aspirational. Something never perfectly achieved. As a settled disposition that results from repeatedly bringing practical reason to bear on our emotions, part of our soul receptive to it, success in the past does not guarantee success in the future, as new situations call out new complexities of emotions. A second feature of Aristotle's account is his view that's pertinent here is his view of the magnanimous person's concern for truth, and we might add for sincerity in relation to others. According to Aristotle, a magnanimous person is necessarily open. That is, she makes no secret of the objects of her affection, and she is no less forthcoming about who or what she doesn't like. He adds, the truth necessarily matters more to her than does someone's opinion, and that she speaks and acts openly. From this emphasis on being open, on not hiding one's feelings, but being truthful to others about them, it follows that Aristotle regards sincerity as part of magnanimity, and thus part of being authentic. However, he adds a crucial caveat in this connection. The caveat stipulates a limit to the openness by way of explaining the motivation for it. The magnanimous person limits her candor when it comes to speaking to the many. When addressing them, she uses irony. This remark comes on the heels of a comment about the difference between the magnanimous person's display of herself to the high and mighty and to ordinary folk. To the former, she does not hide her greatness, but to the latter, she does. Now, this is always a problem in reading Aristotle and figuring out how to interpret it. Some of his observations about the magnanimous, for example, their idleness, their slowness to act, their deep voices, their measured utterances, their fondness for the aesthetic over the utilitarian, these may simply be reports of how they're looked at, and they may not be intended as essential features of the magnanimous person. So you have to, that's a problem, how one separates those two. That's definitely a difficulty. In every society, to be sure, there are differences in social status and importance, and his remarks about the magnanimous person's relation to individuals from different social status may be consistent with her having a true estimate of her worth based upon her virtue alone. Right? So she has to think herself worthy on the basis of her virtue, not on the basis of her superior social status. Okay? Nevertheless, he attributes to the magnanimous person a clear sense of her superiority. The attribution is particularly evident in his comparison of magnanimous persons with their imitators. After noting that the latter reproduce the former's disdain for others, Aristotle observes that someone magnanimous is rightfully disdainful. This sense of superiority explains her reticence to receive benefits, to remember what she has received, or to ask for help, since doing so in each case allegedly betrays inferiority. So, too, it explains the different ways that she relates to those who are and are not, in her view or others' views, her inferiors, whether that inferiority is based upon social position or virtue. Now, Aristotle insists, to be sure, that the magnanimous person's opinions about her truth and about others are true, that those are true opinions. Yet, as noted above, he is less than sincere with others who are regarded as inferior. At least from a contemporary perspective, Aristotle seems to waver between characterizing magnanimity strictly as a virtue and characterizing it in terms of social status. In any case, although virtue and not fortune is supposedly the genuine basis of the magnanimous person's deservedness of honor, it comes with a sense of superiority over specific others. In sum, because of her virtue, the magnanimous person is worthy of great honors and thereby superior to others and cognizant of the fact. Now, prima facie, these features of Aristotle's account of magnanimity, less than fully sincere, ironic approach to some people, sense of superiority, conflict not only with Judeo-Christian beliefs, but also with modern egalitarian ideals. His account also seems to collide with the fact that an honorable person is invariably beholden to realities and powers beyond her for the features and capacities that make her deserving of honor. She didn't create those capacities, or he didn't create them. So these are some difficulties when in the 13th century Aquinas starts to read Aristotle. Aquinas is nevertheless, despite these problems, intent on appropriating Aristotle's account of magnanimity. And he responds to the difficulty of doing so by pairing his conception of magnanimity with humility. Now, difficult as the prospects of this pairing might seem, it is further complicated by the fact that Aquinas construes magnanimity as a part of fortitude, part of courage, and humility as a part of temperance. The complication is no doubt due, at least in part, to the historical context. So when Aquinas first had access to Aristotle's texts and was reading them, there was already a tradition of understanding the virtues in Stoic and Neoplatonic ways. And so part of his account of magnanimity as a form of fortitude and humility as a form of temperance is because those accounts of those virtues were already in place. Despite these complications, Aquinas remains faithful to Aristotle's basic view that honor takes precedence over all external goods. Aquinas maintains that a magnanimous person strives to do things that are worthy of great honor, things that are great simply and absolutely, with little concern for honors as such. Her concern, in other words, is not to be feared or loved by others, but to be deserving of the same. Nonetheless, the honors are great honors, as they are for Aristotle, of the sort facilitated by fortune. In Aquinas' terminology, honors are matter proper to magnanimity, the special good that makes it a special virtue, but they are not the end. In the characterization of this end, Aquinas' modification of Aristotle's account starts to become apparent. The end of magnanimity is to carry out something great that is supposed to be done. Whereas each virtue respectively indicates something that is supposed to be done, magnanimity aims at doing it as honorably as possible and thereby perfecting the virtues as a whole. A person is deserving of honor to the extent that, among other things, she perfects the virtues. Hence, a magnanimous person is indifferent to external goods, presumably the honors themselves, valuing them only to the extent that she considers them useful to perform acts of virtue. So too, she is neither impressed by great honors, since she considers herself above them. She is not broken by being dishonored. She recognizes that the like is done to her undeservedly. So that sounds like a generous gloss on Aristotle by Aquinas. Now, one might contend that Aquinas here is simply tweaking Aristotle's description of magnanimity. But as Tobias Hoffman points out, Aquinas shifts the center of gravity somewhat from Aristotle's account. Whereas magnanimity for Aristotle is a mean for a worthy person's self-esteem simply, Aquinas ties that self-esteem to its import for doing good actions. Someone is magnanimous who esteems himself worthy of great things, that is to say that he may do great things and have them done to him should he indeed be worthy. That's a quote from Aquinas. And Aquinas underscores the fact that a lack of magnanimity is a moral failing, as it may not be for Aristotle. In any case, Aquinas' characterization of magnanimity as a part of fortitude represents a clear departure from Aristotle's conception. A person with fortitude, courage, is able to withstand and combat grave dangers appropriately. She manages to remove impediments to doing the right thing, impediments that principally take the form of fear. In other words, with her eye firmly on the prize, i.e. a good proposed by reason, she manages to suppress those fears and confront mortal dangers steadfastly, even aggressively. So that's the account of fortitude. It's the old idea of grave dangers, mortal dangers. Like fortitude, magnanimity strengthens the soul with respect to something arduous by struggling with passions that resist reason. Whereas fortitude struggles with passions whose strength is in some sense internal to them, passions of excessive fear or daring, magnanimity contends with passions whose force derives from love or craving of honors. Echoing Augustine in this regard, Aquinas speaks of the love or craving of honor and praise. We fail to be magnanimous when succumbing to this craving, we hope for and imagine ourselves deserving of more or less than the honors we deserve. As Aquinas puts it, what fear is to fortitude, hope is to magnanimity. Yet just as virtue in general consists in safeguarding the good of reason in human affairs, fortitude in particular does so in the face of great dangers. So magnanimity is a virtue because it does so in regard to great honors. So he's trying to fit the account of magnanimity into the account of fortitude or courage. Instead of great dangers and the fear of it, it's contending with the desire for honors. Now, earlier I noted how Aquinas modifies Aristotle's conception by stressing the preeminent place of the disposition to perfect the virtues as one of the great things pursued. Aquinas' treatment of magnanimity as a form of fortitude presents a further departure. But the difference between Aquinas and Aristotle's conceptions of this virtue becomes even starker when we turn to the way Aquinas builds humility into a single virtue that also comprises magnanimity. Given the sense of superiority that Aristotle builds into the virtue of magnanimity, its difference from humility seems obvious. To his credit, Aquinas directly confronts this issue, citing Aristotle's apparent claim to that effect, while also noting that Aristotle does not include humility among the virtues. Aquinas' first step in this regard is to demonstrate, nevertheless, that magnanimity and humility are not contraries. That demonstration begins with the observation that in human beings we find great things, gifts from God, as well as defects inherent to the human condition. A person is magnanimous if consideration of those defects leads her to deem herself worthy of, a person is magnanimous if consideration of those gifts leads her to deem herself worthy of great things. She is humble if consideration of her shortcomings leads her to give little weight to herself. These considerations, though made by the same person, are patently different. Hence Aquinas concludes magnanimity and humility are not contraries, though they do pull in different directions. Yet far from being content with demonstrating the non-contrariety of magnanimity and humility, Aquinas wants to show their complementarity and mutual necessity. His first move in this direction is to note the different sorts of attitudes produced by pursuit of an arduous good. The goodness of this end, i.e. the fact that there's a good reason for it, makes it attractive, prompting hopes and dreams for it. The difficulty of obtaining it, however, has the opposite effect, prompting resignation and despair. In other words, we experience hope if the good appears attainable, despair if not. From the fact that the nature of the good affects us in both ways at once, hoping for it and despairing of it, Aquinas infers the need for a twofold virtue, duplex virtus. It comprises one virtue that tempers and restrains the soul lest it tend immoderately to lofty things, and another that strengthens the soul against despair and impels it to the pursuit of great things in keeping with right reason. So it requires both humility and magnanimity. It would be a mistake to hope for too much as it would be to despair. To hope for too little, humility restrains the former hope. Humility restrains the former hope, magnanimity counters the latter. Now, he doesn't give us much clarification of how he's using the term duplex, and there's all kinds of difficulties with that, how exactly we're going to understand this twofold virtue in metaphysical or epistemological terms. But in any case, he considers magnanimity and humility distinct, having distinct rationales. He refers to them both in different places as moral virtues. Yet their complementarity and mutual necessity follow from the fact that they respectively manage emotions concerned with the same thing, the same arduous good, and do so as dictated by reason. Whereas magnanimity, as a part of temperance, as a part of virtue, gives us the courage to pursue great things within reason, humility as a part of temperance has the moderating effect of curbing our tendencies to pursue them excessively. Any pursuit of great things on our part requires magnanimity and humility, the former to fortify us against acquiescence and defeatism, the latter to counter presumptuous hopes and excessive self-confidence. Those are all translations of Aquinas' Latin. In order to avoid being carried away into things beyond her, a person needs to know her limits. This knowledge helps her regulate her inclinations and desires, quote, so that she does not esteem herself beyond what she is, end of quote. Indeed, in contrast to pride, quote, humility attends to the rule of right reason according to which someone has a true estimate of herself, end of quote. These are literal translations of Aquinas. Estimate of herself, does not esteem herself beyond what she is. So that clearly he's talking about something like selfhood here. Aquinas takes pains in this connection to spell out the relation between humility and the relevant knowledge. The knowledge that takes the form of a rule guiding a person's appetite for great things and the honors they bring. While supposing this knowledge, humility is not the knowledge. The true estimate of oneself is such. Instead, Aquinas emphasizes, humility essentially consists in the appetite itself, the desire itself. Humility is a person's settled disposition of modifying her inclinations, her presumptuous hope, and making choices both in keeping with what is reasonable. Now, this qualification obviously cannot mean that a person who possesses humility must have a perfectly true estimate of herself. But it does mean a practice of abiding by a reasonable rule, a rule most likely to provide a person with some measure of a true estimate of her capacities. In this way, Aquinas is simply reinforcing the basic contention that humility is a virtue. Neither a desire nor neither an emotion nor an act nor a decision, though it touches as a virtue on all of them. For Aristotle, too, as noted above, a magnanimous person has a true estimate of herself, albeit an estimate that includes an awareness of her deservedness of honors and superiority to most other people. By contrast, for Aquinas, one of the effects of a human person's true estimate of herself is that, quote, she laudably casts herself down in the lowest places, end of quote. This projection, deixio in the Latin, displays not self-contempt tout court, but contempt for one's moral failings and contriteness in the face of them. When a person has the habit of the virtue of humility, she's in the habit of attempting to secure a true estimate of herself, but with the regret of not being able to do so unfailingly. With humility comes a sense of remorse in the face of our failings, along with the understanding that a lifetime of virtue can never completely eradicate the inclinations responsible for them. But by the same token, humility provides a powerful foundation for gratitude, at odds with elements in Aristotle's portrait of magnanimity. The contrast with Aristotelian magnanimity is sharpened further by the different relations to others in the two conceptions. There is a similarity. Just as a magnanimous person recognizes her superiority to most other people, so humility entails an awareness of capacities. Aquinas writes, what is of God in oneself that are not subject to the authority of others. There's something that's not subject to the authority of others, and humility is the awareness of that. Nonetheless, Aquinas adds, since reverence is owed to what is from God in everyone, quote, we ought through humility to subject ourselves to all our neighbors for God's sake, end of quote. So it also requires a certain degree of subjection to the community. Herein lies a salient part of the reason for thinking that magnanimity and humility make up a twofold virtue. Humility puts the brakes on presumptiveness, the aspiration to be superior to others who are, in fact, our equals in God's eyes. Humility restrains the desire to make others in our own image, in effect, the image of what renders us feared or loved in their sight. By construing humility and magnanimity as one, Aquinas lays the groundwork for expanding the potential for magnanimity beyond confines conferred by a particular social status. The fundamental feature of magnanimity, the settled disposition of esteeming oneself appropriately, remains. But the honors need not be the great honors paid to society's blue bloods, but the great honors deserved by anyone who lives a virtuous life. In this sense, sistered with humility, magnanimity becomes a virtue of liberal politics, not tied to a particular class or station, but spread equally across the entire community of God's children. Now, on the previous pages, I've tried to show how Aquinas modifies Aristotle's conception of magnanimity, transforming it into a virtue that demands humility no less than a sense of one's honorableness. The fact that the twofold virtue is elaborated by Aquinas is directly concerned with honors, places it squarely in the context of the issues of identity and authenticity. The primary challenge to authenticity I've been suggesting is what Augustine characterizes as the inordinate desire to be feared or loved by others, a desire that springs in no small part from insecurity. Insecurity about the very prospects of preserving oneself and one's personal identity. I've introduced Aquinas' account of magnanimity to dispute the popular view that authenticity in this sense is an exclusively modern moral concern. By way of concluding, I'd like to make explicit some neglected implications of Aquinas' account. The first implication is for the meaning of authenticity itself. Viewed as the virtue of being true to ourselves, being authentic requires us to be true to what is most essential to us. That is a distinctive potential to excel that each of us possesses as part of an unfinished personal identity, organic, embodied, and social, and the experience of it. To excel as a human being is, as both Aristotle and Aquinas stress, to be in the habit of striving to be honorable, to be worthy of esteem. To achieve this excellence, they also agree, is exceedingly difficult, given false hopes and presumptuous delusions on the one hand, and unreasonable fears and despair in our abilities on the other. Hence, being true to ourselves in this regard requires nothing less than a virtuous combination of magnanimity and humility. We would not be true to ourselves were we to fasten single-mindedly on high-flying hopes, ignoring our reasonable fears, or let our fears smother our hopes. In other words, being authentic demands the virtue of humility to moderate our hopes so that we do not succumb, driven by insecurities, to the notion of being more deserving than we in fact are. But it also demands no less than the virtue of magnanimity to embolden us in the face of our insecurities to strive to do what is honorable, to accomplish what makes us genuinely worthy of esteem. A further implication of Aquinas' account is the fragility of authenticity, its dependence on factors beyond ourselves. In order to come to a true estimate and esteem of ourselves, we need help, and not only in the form of good fortune. We also desperately need others to show us not only who we are and optimally can be, but also the worthiness and, yes, the lovableness of being true to that reality and potential. Only with the help of others, in former times, one might say the communion of saints, can we approach some measure of a true estimate of ourselves. An estimate that makes abundantly clear our neediness and dependence upon others, as well as our genuine prospects for doing great things, the sort of things that confirm our honorableness. Now, I've been using the first person plural here rather loosely, and that's a bit problematic when we recall that Aquinas uses the singular pronouns rather exclusively. But I do so deliberately, since humility restrains our hope in ourselves both individually and collectively. Restraining this hope coincides with having a true estimate of our personal identities as embodied individuals, the social identities incorporated in those personal identities, and the identities of the societies in which we find ourselves. In corresponding ways, magnanimity gives us the strength to realize the potential for excellence that resides in these identities. So I have a larger story here that there's embodied identities, a social identity that are part of a personal identity. Within that larger picture of personal identity, the only parts that we can concern ourselves with are those for which we have some self-understanding. So that's in the background of this account here. Humility is a matter of being true to the experience of our limitations, thrown into the world as we are, embodied in a distinctive time space and utterly dependent upon it. Yet being true to that experience brings with it the promise of the possibilities for excellence that we project for ourselves in that same world. We find ourselves outfitted with the fragile but real potential to survive and perhaps flourish and excel, but only if we are true to this potential, that is, only if, thanks to others and powers beyond our control, we have the greatness of soul to combat our fears of failing and reach out to what is reasonably within our reach. Now, recognizing our dependency on others is central to the virtue of humility, the virtue that, together with magnanimity, I am calling the virtue of authenticity. As noted above, Aquinas stresses that humility requires a degree of submissiveness to others, specifically to that which is from God in everyone else. This aspect of the virtue of humility contrasts sharply with the modern narrative that authenticity and sincerity come apart. Being authentic by way of the virtue of humility and magnanimity entails being honest about oneself, with oneself, and others. This virtue is singularly at odds with any attempt to render one's words or behavior more attractive or beguiling than truthful. To be insincere is precisely to attempt to shape, even master, how others regard us, to have them fear or love us rather than see us for what we are and love us accordingly. Now, to be sure, the whole point of the fuss over Rameau's nephew, the advance it allegedly represents over Rousseau, was to illustrate a sincerity that is disturbing because it is authentic, someone who is sincerely amoral because he is authentic. But note that authenticity here refers to who Rameau happens to be, or Rameau's nephew, rather, divorced from who he can or should be. The modern narrative is right to argue that supposed sincerity without authenticity, the narrative's image of Rousseau, is insincere. But the narrative would have us believe that authenticity and any sincerity it entails, read Rameau's nephew or Joseph Conrad's Kurtz, can only exist in a moral vacuum. We can follow Shakespeare's exhortation on this modern view only if we take the plunge into the heart of darkness where there is no moral light. So you're only really authentic when you've reached that point where you're beyond morality. That's the idea here. But like the figures that supposedly epitomize it, this position is pure fantasy. I mean, it's based on literary figures. It disastrously overlooks how personal identity is a fusion of a person's embodied identity with her social identities, how that fusion permits obfuscation and deception only against the backdrop of truth and truthfulness, how language and other cultural accoutrements are enabling, no less than confining, how the means of being sincere suppose the experience of sincerity. The experience of being insincere supposes the experience of sincerity. As mentioned earlier, the narrative also treats sincerity and authenticity alike as facts or permanent character traits, as they are, because these are about stories which have been written and they've established who the characters are. They treat these as facts or permanent character traits rather than as virtues that embody settled but unfinished dispositions that can only be rendered intelligible and real by reference not only to aspirations and ideals but to repeated tests of them. Viewed through the lens of Aquinas' twofold virtue of authenticity, Rameau's nephew and Conrad's Kurtz are both singularly lacking in humility and magnanimity. Their sincerity is inauthentic precisely because they regard all social intercourse as a sham, rather than as an inherent part of their lives, limiting in certain respects, liberating in others. Lacking humility, they refuse to accept these limitations. Lacking magnanimity, they despair of exploiting that liberating, indeed transformative promise of life with others. Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard the 37th Annual Henri J. Renard S.J. Endowed Lecture in Philosophy, presented yearly by the Creighton University Department of Philosophy. This year's guest speaker has been Daniel Dahlstrom, John R. Silber Professor of Philosophy at Boston University, and author of several books, including The Heidegger Dictionary and Philosophical Legacies, Essays on the Thought of Kant, Hegel, and Their Contemporaries. He spoke on the topic Authenticity and Humility. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, March 23, 2017, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.